Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of the Versus History Podcast. It's me, your host, History Chappie, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, on behalf of the editors. And today, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Natalie Haynes, who is the author of a brand new book entitled Stoneblind. So that's enough from me. More from you, Natalie. How are you? And welcome to Versus History.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm fine, thank you. A little kind of chaotic, but no more than I normally am around publication time. So, you know, this is about as sane as I ever will be when a book's coming out. So, yeah.
We celebrate slightly chaotic. God, tell us all about you, your background, and then a little bit about your book and why you chose to write it. So I'm aware I've thrown a lot of questions.
It's quite a lot of questions, isn't it?
Let's break it down. Just tell us about you and your background, Natalie.
Okay, my name is Natalie Haynes, and I am a writer and broadcaster and classicist. I used to be a stand-up comedian, and that was through my 20s into my early 30s. And then essentially I decided that I would run away from the circus and join the library, which I always think is the right way to do things. And so I studied classics at school and at uni. That's what my degree is in. And I wrote a book, a nonfiction book in 2010 called The Ancient Guide to Modern Life, which looked at the modern world and refracted it through the prism of the ancient world. And then I wrote a series of novels that were based on Greek myth, one set in the modern world, Amber Fury, which came out in 2014, and then two set in the Bronze Age, Children of Jocasta, which was 2017, and A Thousand Ships, which was 2019, and that one was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. I wrote another nonfiction book about women in Greek myth called Pandora's Jar, which came out in 2020. And Stoneblind is therefore my, seventh book. And this is the story of Medusa, one of the Gorgons, who is a much more complicated character than I think most of us realize. I think for most of us, she's just a monster because the Gorgon head, Medusa's head, is seen as such a sort of monstrous thing. And I wrote a non-fiction chapter about her in Pandora's Jar. And I thought, yeah, she's really not a monster. She's sort of the first monstered woman. She's a monstered rape survivor. She's attacked and then she's cursed because she's been attacked. And I thought, yeah, I'm still cross about that. I'm going to write her a novel. So this is how I made myself and her feel better. At least that was the idea.
Go. Well, let's give a shout out to your school because I've heard that I'm a school teacher myself. But I've heard many schools teaching or don't teach the classics. So could give a shout out to your school. Who was your teacher and where?
I went to King Edward VI High School for Girls in Birmingham. I grew up in Birmingham and I know I've been gone a long time now, so it's a bit hard to hear sometimes.
Yeah, you have a nil accent in terms of...
If I'm cross, you can hear it in my U sounds. I have to remember to say, wait, hold on, toothbrush. Because my instinct is to say toothbrush, and I know I'm not allowed because I used to get mocked for it so ruthlessly at university, which I think now we would call sort of regionist bullying, but at the time just had to live with because time makes ancient good uncouth, I guess. So I was taught classics really brilliantly, and I was very, very lucky because, as you say, the vast majority of teaching of Latin and Greek, and I studied both of those to A level, which is nearly impossible to do now, happens in private schools. And only 7% of students in the UK go to private schools. So there is a lot more teaching of classical civilization, classics and translation, essentially in the state sector. So there is a real thirst for classics, which is being, you know, provided for by brilliant teachers who are giving up not just their, you know, regular time teaching, but often they're teaching classics or Latin or sometimes even Greek in their lunch times and after school. And, you know, it's just... this year is tough to get school visits in, but I do try and maintain connections with the schools I've been visiting over the last sort of decade or so, even if I can't add in new ones, because I think it's just really important, not just to go and talk to the kids, because I was well into my 20s before I sort of realised and accepted that being an author was a job a person could have like me, as opposed to a job that a sort of rarefied person had to do. But I also think teachers deserve our support.
Absolutely. I'll give a quick shout out to my colleague, Connell Smith, who's an editor for Versus History. He does Latin Club at lunchtime.
And when you see, they can't resist it. They can't resist taking up their time and just going, let's allow some students to discover Latin because it's important. I find it so impressive, but also actually incredibly moving that people feel so strongly about something I feel really passionately about, that they're prepared to give up their time. Because literally there isn't a teacher alive who gets to lunchtime and goes, wow, I am bored of free time. I should really go teach an extra class.
That is very, very true. So shout out to Connell for his Latin club. And when I worked at Colombo International School, a lady called Sarah taught classical civilization to A-level as well. So shout out to her. Anyway, more about you than Natalie. So tell us about your book. What's it all about and why did you choose to write it?
Well, it's a novel about Medusa and about the many, many, many women in the story of Medusa. And I think normally this story has been framed as Perseus's story. You know, a Greek hero goes off to cut off the head of a monster. And that's how we tend to look at it. We do the same with Theseus and the Minotaur, you know, and then every now and then somebody makes you look at things differently. So Borges, the very brilliant short story writer, did a short story called The House of Asterion, which imagined what it would be like to have that encounter of Theseus and the Minotaur in the labyrinth from the Minotaur's perspective. We never remember that his name is Asterion, but he's half person. He's only half cow or bull, I guess, if you prefer. And so he sort of humanized that monster. And this tiny story, it's only a few pages long, it's just desperately moving and very beautiful. And so I suppose what I wanted to do was ask the question of what makes a monster? Because I think too often we go, oh, well, it looks scary, so it's a monster. And sometimes I think the sort of modern theme that's running through this is we think, oh, that looks terrifying or upsetting, so I'm just going to kind of call it a monster. And I think that's often what happens when people give testimony about terrible things that have happened to them, and women talk. You know, the reason that Me Too was such a huge movement was women were suddenly saying, well, I was assaulted. And sometimes people said, that's terrible, let me listen to you. And sometimes people kind of said, oh, well, you must have been asking for it, because I think it doesn't necessarily come from a place of cruelty, although that response is undeniably cruel. I think sometimes it's like, I can't bear to look. And I felt like the story of Medusa, who obviously has this super powerful gaze, which can turn you to stone. It's like, this is the original parable for male fear of a female gaze. But here's the thing. Is she a monster? Because when she's alive and she has agency over what happens, she doesn't kill anyone. It's only when Perseus has decapitated her and uses her head as a weapon of mass destruction. There's a story in Ovid where he kills 200 people at once at a wedding. Then she becomes a terrifying force for murder or death. But of her own accord, she isn't. And I thought that's a story that really needs telling. And there are lots of other female characters in her story, goddesses and Gorgon sisters and all kinds of other people lurking around. And I thought, this is a chance to write another polyphonic novel, you know, as I did with A Thousand Ships, a book with lots of different women's voices in it, and to tell the story of this whole person rather than just tell the story of a monstrous head.
Thanks, Natalie. Okay, I think you've already touched on some of this, but can you tell us a little bit about Medusa and sort of who she is, and I think you touched on this as well, some of the misconceptions that you've come across.
Yeah, of course. So she's one of three Gorgon sisters, and we find out about her in, for example, Hesiod, who wrote a poem called The Theogony. He's a very early poet, same sort of time as Homer. That just has like a sentence about the Gorgons. It says there are three of them called Steno, Euryale, and Medusa, and two of them are immortal, and Medusa is mortal, and he just throws it away. Oh, that's a terrible fate. And it's like, wait, what? I mean, yes, that is a terrible fate, Hesiod. Could you tell me more? But he sort of loses interest, goes on to talk about the next thing, you know? And so I felt like that this was an angle that I could really come in on, because obviously if she's mortal, she's going to grow and change. You know, the whole point of gods and goddesses is that they are unchanging, they're immortal, they're deathless, as they are in Greek, athanatos. And I thought, well, what would it be like for two immortals, her Gorgon sisters, to suddenly have this changing, growing Gorgon with them? It's just going to be different. And so that was sort of part of the thing that I wanted to do. I think a lot of misconceptions about Medusa are that she's always a monster, and that's just not true. You know, we're told by Pindar, again, a very early poet, that she is very beautiful, that she has lots of suitors, and she's cursed by Athene. She's raped by Poseidon in the temple of Athene, and Athene doesn't blame Poseidon. She blames Medusa for the blasphemy, the profanation of her temple. And so she curses her. She gives her snakes for hair. And she gives her, in some versions of the story, at that point, she acquires the ability to turn things to stone, but it's an ability she can't turn off. So I thought, well, what would it be like to have that quality where you couldn't look at anything without destroying it? What if you didn't want to destroy it? You know, what if you were looking at something you loved? And so that was the sort of beginning of it, I guess. I did a comparison in Pandora's Jar between Medusa and Midas, who, of course, gets a wish granted. So he's not cursed. It's something he's chosen to turn everything to gold. And I asked the question, why do we always look at his story from the inside and hers from the outside? So when we think of Midas, we say, God, it must be terrible to be Midas. Imagine if it was like that and everything I touched turned to gold, I wouldn't be able to eat or drink. But when we look at Medusa, we say, oh God, it would be terrible to come across Medusa. Where would I hide in order not for her to not turn me to stone? It's like, well, why aren't we thinking about what it's like for her? Why don't we think about it from her perspective? And so this novel was my determined attempt to do that.
Okay, just a curveball question then, just picking up on what you've been saying. Is it apt to look at Medusa as a victim then, or is that not?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, she is a victim of multiple gods. A conspiracy, essentially. Poseidon attacks her with sexual assault. Athene attacks her with a curse, tears out her hair, gives her snakes instead. And then other gods conspire to help Perseus in his assassination of her. And there's no other word for it. You know, there's a vase painting in the Metropolitan Museum in New York where you can see Perseus kind of creeping up behind her, and she's asleep. She's fast asleep, and she's not a monster in this version. It's a 5th century vase, and her hair is sort of beautiful black ringlets. She doesn't have snakes at all. Not that snakes are intrinsically monstrous, of course, but she's just asleep. And Perseus is looking behind him at Athene, who's helping him to behead Medusa. And he's got this curved sword. It's called a harpe in Greek, and it's sort of embracing her neck. And when you see this scene without any kind of context, what you see is a man attacking a woman as she sleeps. And it's like, well, okay, this is a story that I don't think we think about. She is a victim of terrible violence done to her over and over again from multiple angles. And so, yeah, I felt like this was a part of the story that people just haven't been told. So it seemed like a good time to tell it.
Absolutely, and we're very glad you did. Okay, next question. How did you go about researching for this book?
Yeah, it was quite a different experience doing research for this book from my previous books, and particularly from A Thousand Ships, because you'd think they would be quite similar, but actually there are very, very few literary sources about Medusa. There's a relatively long section in Ovid's Metamorphoses, but it's entirely focused on Perseus, so she's sort of an incidental part of the story in that regard. And there are these kind of tiny mentions in Pindar and Hesiod, but literally just a few words. What there are, though, and you know, contrast that with stories like the Trojan War, where we've got loads of, you've got two epic poems just by Homer before you go and look at all those plays by Euripides, Sophocles, Aeschylus, and so on. And so there were many, many fewer literary sources, but what there are for Medusa is lots of visual arts, lots of vase paintings and sculptures. So I spent a lot of time looking at and thinking about those because it felt like some of those places were really the best place I could. So I had kind of snapshots, I guess, from these different depictions, some of which are very upsetting. You know, some of them show incredible violence has been done to her. Her body, you know, when her head has been taken off, just left, and it's just so upsetting. And so it was quite a sort of isolated story in lots of ways. But the thing is that when I wrote it, or when I started writing it, London, where I live in the UK, was under lockdown So I was isolated too. So it's a very, you know, it was only after I'd finished it, I realized that I'd sort of written myself a new family to make up for the ones I couldn't see, like a crazy person might. That's sort of how it happened.
Well, I think, again, you've touched on the next question I'm going to ask. What were the biggest challenges or the biggest single challenge that you faced whilst writing this book, Stone Blind, Medusa's Story?
Well, I guess probably the biggest challenge was trying to work out which sections I could include, essentially, which parts of the story I could include and which ones I needed to take out. It's a book that has a lot of tonal range. So scenes which just focus on the goddesses or gods on Mount Olympus are much more lighthearted. They're much funnier, more ruthless. And scenes that focus on the Gorgons are much sort of warmer. As, you know, like, this is a real family, and where is the real family in this story? And spoiler alert, it's the monsters, as we were. Real family who experience love and nurturing and all of those things, and the family of gods that we're used to sort of thinking of as quite a dysfunctional family from Homer onwards, really, have nothing like the same intimacy that the Gorgons have. And of course, there are also human families. Perseus has a family, he has a mother called Danae, and they have a different relationship again. And then there's a whole other family, the royal family of Ethiopia. Andromeda is the princess, daughter of Cassiope, sometimes she's called Cassiopeia, and Cepheus. And their story is intertwined with Medusa's too. So it was a question of sort of picking which area of the story to focus on at any given time is sort of the most challenging part. But also, truthfully, the act of writing when you're sort of when you're so isolated was sometimes very hard. I do see it's not going down a mine. I wasn't at risk. It was, you know, it was a safe job to have, but it was sometimes very lonely.
Well, thank you very much, Natalie. Is there anything else, because that exhausts the questions for me, anything else you'd like us to know about the book before we conclude?
Do you want me to read you the very first page? It's only a little paragraph.
Why not? Go for it. Go for
Why
it.
Why not? I love a very short first chapter. I'm a huge fan of this. So this chapter is entitled Gorgoneion. A Gorgoneion, by the way, is the head of a Gorgon. I see you. I see all those whom men call monsters. And I see the men who call them that, call themselves heroes, of course. I only see them for an instant. Then they're gone. But it's enough. Enough to know that the hero isn't the one who's kind or brave or loyal. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes, he is monstrous. And the monster, who is she? She is what happens when someone cannot be saved. This particular monster is assaulted, abused, and vilified. And yet, as the story is always told, she is the one you should fear. She is the monster. We'll see about that. She's quite an angry Gorgoneion, in case it's not clear.
Wow. Well, there you go. If you like that. I mean, is there an audio book? Because that was pretty...
There is. There is an audio book.
There you
book,
go, folks.
Yes.
So, Natalie, remind us, what's the book called? Who's it published by? Where can we get it? And is there and if anyone's got any questions or want to tell you how great the book is or otherwise, is there any way they can get hold of you?
The book is called Stone Blind, and it's available from September 15th. I should know that. It's published by Macmillan, by the Mantle imprint of Macmillan. And it should be available to you everywhere. If you pre-order it, I know some people hate the word pre-order, but it's the word you have to use for you order it, but you don't get it immediately. If you pre-order it, you can get a fancy version with sprayed edges, or I believe they're known as spredges in the book community, which are very beautiful. So that's my suggestion. Get a fancy one. I'm hoping they're going to send me those. And if you want to track me down, then I am on all social media where you'd expect me to be lurking around. So find me and say hello.
Excellent. There you go. Some digging to do, folks. Get pre-ordering that book and get the one with the fancy, colourful...
Spreadges.
There you go. Fantastic. Oh, look. Natalie Haynes, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us. It's been a genuine pleasure, a short but sweet interview. I knew absolutely nothing about Medusa apart from all the hackneyed tosh that you've very happily just sort of trashed for me, which is great.
And you're welcome. Always here to destroy things.
There you go. I've not even read the book yet, but I will over half term. So, Natalie, thank you very, very much indeed for coming on to Versus Issue today. It's been an absolute pleasure. We wish you every success with your book, Stoneblind, Medusa's Story.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History Podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.